Hi, and welcome to Bloody Good Reads. I'm your host, Mark Goddard. And yet again, we're joined by another amazing guest. A guest who I've met on several occasions. We do have a conversational history, which is absolutely brilliant. So I have a bit more to talk about with this guest here today. A bit of a personal note, he's been a huge help and a huge influence to me when I first started out with writing and podcasting. He is the author of the amazing superhero series, Hero.com, Villain.net, the Tarzan series as well, and has a bit of a history in screenwriting and in horror movies. So our guest this week is the amazing Andy Briggs. Welcome to the podcast.
Ah, it's good to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So we know we've spoken throughout the years, so this is going to be an interesting one because I know a few talking points I want to go to, but welcome to the podcast. So what we would normally do here at the start of the podcast is basically tell us a little bit about yourself and then we'll get into your career and we'll have a little chat about your bloody good reads, which is always an interesting part of the podcast.
My history of horror. First of all, horror films were the very, very first thing that I'd always tried to watch, you know, watching the old Universal monster movies and all that kind of stuff. Creature from the Black Lagoon, loved it all. So just as a kid, the one thing I'd always bunk away to try and do is watch a good old horror movie. And that kind of stayed with me for, forever. And then I sort of segued into writing. Trying to get an agent, trying to write, trying to get things made. And then along with my brother, Peter, we had the good fortune, or he had the good fortune of leaping straight down the throat of Hollywood with a little film called Alien vs. Predator. And then from there, we ended up doing a whole bunch of things, the most fun of which in the horror vein, had to be one of the many writers on Freddy versus Jason, which was fun and a little bit of a geeky moment. And then I ended up writing a whole bunch of horror things for the Sci-Fi Channel, which was always good fun. Anything with poor young girls running around being chased by gargoyles and various monsters is always terrific. And I kind of just drifted in and out that I wrote other things and then moved into the world of books, like you've mentioned, superhero books and Tarzan, and have my eye on a couple of horror books in the not too distant future, along with actually producing now as well as writing. So there's a couple of horror movies in that pipeline. And the very strange possibility I might actually be directing a horror film later this year, but who knows? Certainly not me, but it's in the pipeline.
Because I know you more from your young adult books, and I know from our previous conversations it's a Freddy versus Jason, so I know that you do have a whole love of horror. So if anybody ever says, why have we got a young adult author on here? One, because the books are amazing. Two, you have a history of horror. So there you go.
Horror is one of those odd topics because, what do people define as horror? Which is an interesting question in itself. One of my recent movies was a movie called Crowhurst, which was a true story about a guy who set sail around the world and suddenly goes mad. It's a true story. By every definition, it's a horror film. And the way the director Simon Rumley made that on the screen, it is absolutely a psychological horror film. So, even people saying, well, young adult books, what's that got to do with horror? Well, quite a lot. The story beats and structures and rhythms all kind of gel together.
So where did you start out? Because I know you were writing first screenwriting first before you went into books, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it was basically, my older brother Peter sold a spec script, which was Alien versus Predator. It was 15 years, I think, before the film ever got made. It's a long gestation period of that movie. And then amongst all that, a whole bunch of offers for work came along, including Judge Dredd, which people would say, well, that's not a horror movie, but actually, funnily enough, the story we worked on was the classic Judge Death story. So if you've essentially got four undead spirits going around killing people, that's classed as horror, surely. Cool. And then, of course, Freddy versus Jason, which was just a wonderful excuse to watch every single one of those films back to back and try and knit them together. So that's where that kind of came from, and everything else came from that moment. And then that segued into working with the Sci-Fi Channel. So did a whole bunch of, at the time, high-end movies. Budgets have gone through the roof since then. One called Dark Relic, which was a wonderful demon loose in killing a bunch of knights with James Frayne, which was terrific fun. Rise of the Gargoyle, which was exactly what you think it's about. Kill a gargoyle on the loose in Paris.
Which is a good fun film, actually. I've managed to watch that one. It was a fun film.
Oh, terrific. it was a lot. It nearly never got made until I pointed out I just arrived back from Bucharest and it doubles for Paris. But yeah, it's a silly fun film, but it's still a fun film, and we did that on the budget. And a little known Wild West horror movie called Ghost Town, which was it's not fantastic, but it was jolly good fun. Bunch of students get lost, and it's a whole bunch of ghostly cowboys slaughtering them. Terrific fun. So all of that was before the YA books. So, yeah, when you've done that kind of work and then you move into young adult books and people think, well, it's not quite the same. Well, you know, there is a lot of lessons to be learned, a lot of villains to be gained from the horror.
What was the idea behind Hero.comvillain.next? Because it's a series that you can't really, you've never really seen before, which is the same story, but it's from the hero's point of view and the villain's point of view. I mean, where did the idea for that one come along?
The hero, again, just love of films in general and superheroes and Stan Lee, etc. And one day, I mean, bear in mind, this was just as iTunes was being born. The idea of what would happen if you could just click a button and download a superhero power. So for a couple hours, you could fly, you could have X-ray vision. And that's kind of where it came from. And then when I pitched the books, it was a blur what happened. They were interested in the hero books. And I said, hey, you could have two parallel series, the hero.com series and the villain.net series. And the same worlds, but different stories, but the characters combine and play cameos in each other's books. And if you read both books together, then you actually get another story. And bizarrely, they went for it. We ended up doing 8 books in the series with all kinds of wonderful supervillains. Being a huge Stan Lee fan, it was a great excuse to invent some new ones. And again, just to touch back on horror, I mean, we had some real fun characters in those books, like Necros, who had just all his superhero powers are actually just villainous powers based on the dead. And you could just throw them in a children's book and have tons of fun with them and get away with it. We had characters, very timely, one called Viral, who could create viruses and pandemics. So it's
for now.
Yeah, it, absolutely perfect. But so it was a lovely kind of smorgasbord of superhero, horror, action, adventure, world travel. And funnily enough, I got to work, my brother and I ended up working with Stanley, and we got to know him as a friend on a film which unfortunately never saw the light of day, called Forever Man, but you can see bits all over the internet. And we were at Comic-Con in San Diego, and I saw Stan in the green room. I was on a panel and I saw Stan in the green room and said, Stan! He cowered in terror. And I told him about the books and said, would you give me a one-line quote? And he said, just send me the books. I sent him the books, and then about 2 or 3 weeks later, got this huge A4 quote. And he called me up saying, just cut it however you want it. And it was just such an honor and a humbling moment to think, oh my God, Stan Lee's just endorsed my superhero book.
He is a legend.
He was just such a weirdly, to say this, down to earth, real nice guy, but with that whole, you know, epicness behind him. I'll tell you a little story. My brother and I were sitting, meeting him. He was going through notes of the film. And I'd just arrived in LA, and I excitedly said, we had an office on the Paramount Studios lot. And this little scruffy guy walked past me. And as he walked past, I realized it was Steven Spielberg. And I was geeking out at that story. And Stan just nodded and smiled. and then pointed at the wall behind us, and we turned, and there's a picture of him and Spielberg on the wall shaking hands. And Stan turns to us and said, "Yeah, that's when Spielberg met me." And you think, yeah, that's the right way around. That's the way it should be.
Yeah. Maybe he created the legends, you know, Spider-Man creator, my favorite Spider-Man. But okay, let's just ask the question: favorite Marvel or favorite superhero? Kind of.
Well, it's a sad thing I have to say. It is Spider-Man, but it was the Amazing Spider-Man, not the Spectacular Spider-Man, and not the umpteen other versions they did after. But the Amazing Spider-Man always was my favorite, followed very closely by Daredevil. They were the little pocket money I had coming from working class family up north. They were the two I'd throw my money at time and time again.
Red suit Daredevil or yellow suit Daredevil?
Red suit.
Oh, of course.
Of course. How old do you think I am? Jeez.
Hey, I'll go back and read them. It's very hard to know where to start with the Spider-Man ones, but yeah. Because I enjoy the Amazing ones. Really love the Ultimate because I love the general arc of the Ultimate Spider-Man. But
absolutely, what I enjoyed about those was going back where you could have a story that would last an issue, or pushing the boat out, it might last four or six issues, and you didn't have to read a million other comics to get the full story. And I think that's where comics have completely lost the way and alienated a lot of the younger audience. Is in doing that.
It's too many years of history, I find. You don't really know where to start. At least with the Ultimate series, you could start. There's a start and there's an end now. So, you know, that's a series you can just read from start to end, which is quite cool. But
absolutely.
Anyway, I'll get off the subject of superheroes. Be here all day. What we'll do, we'll segue in to your first bloody good read.
So, I thought long and hard about this to try and get something that was on all three occasions, maybe a little bit different, that resonates. So the first one is possibly going to be the one that you're going to go, well, how does this possibly resonate? It's a Michael Crichton book. And it's a Michael Crichton book that most people would not have read. Possibly his least read Michael Crichton book on the planet. And it's called Travels. And not only is it a lesser-known Michael Crichton book, it's also a non-fiction book. So it's got all the elements that make you think, what? Why are you bringing this up? So this essentially is a fantastic book. It's actually up there in non-fiction books, in my view, with Stephen King's On Writing. For any people out there who are creative, it's just a fantastic book. And it's Michael Crichton documenting how he did things, how he became Michael Crichton and what influenced him. So starts off from his medical student days when he's sawing the skull off a corpse. And then he realizes he doesn't want to become a doctor. He starts writing these kind of crime stories, starts winning awards. He goes off. He directs the first great train robbery with Sean Connery and, all these wonderful things he does, and it's his whole life, and you see him travel the world. So it's in kind of two parts why I love this book. The first part is he's traveling the world, he's meeting other cultures, and you can see how not only it influences his writing, but also the way he creates stories. And he's seeing other cultures and thinking, this is wonderful, and this is a terrific, diverse world. Let's put this into a book. And he talks about going on an African safari, and you can see all those beats in Jurassic Park, like with the T-Rex, the eye through the car window, all of that more or less happened with an elephant. And you've got these wonderful things all the way through. And then as you go through, you realize there's a little bit of a spiritual kind of edge to it, not in a religious way, in a spiritual way, where he's looking at things like spoon bending and mind reading and astral projection. And he starts as a serious trained scientist to get in and investigate and look at how this could possibly be real. And very wary that, Conan Doyle, he's treading the same steps Conan Doyle did, who was heavily discredited, of course. And that always worried him. And it's a beautiful kind of weaving his kind of supernatural story through making films, writing books, and what he believes. Is there a life after death? Could there be, you know, ghosts or the undead? But it's really interesting having a scientist objectively looking at this and giving you the side of the story. So Travels by Michael Crichton, I think it's kind of my go-to book when I want to go on holiday. I want to sit down with a book that is just going to be totally irrelevant fun, like a Clive Cussler action adventure where I don't have to think about anything, and Travels, where it just helps spur my creativity and just makes me think of the world a little bit more broadly than usual.
So, going on from Hero.com, villain.net, was it before Tarzan or after Tarzan that Ritual was released?
That was before. So again, just going back to my love of horror. So I got the opportunity to write a few graphic novels, and they all turned into horror graphic novels. So my very first one was Ritual, which was just, I love the Nightmare on Elm Street stories. I love those kind of classic, easy, slightly kind of cheesy, you know, Candyman, all those kind of 80s, 90s, early 90s films are just joyful horror films. And I wanted to do something similar. So Ritual came about the idea that, well, what would happen if a bunch of people found this crucified body in a church, and it was of an old witch finder general out of Salem who basically used the Salem witch trials to kill and rape his way across America, because, you know, any young girl, you know, he'd sort of abuse and then kill and say, oh, well, she was a witch, and get away with it. And he was found, hung, quartered, put against the wall, and his spirit comes back in this small sleepy village. So then there's a series of murders. So it's a little bit kind of, you know, influenced by the likes of Seven. So there's some murders. The FBI move in to find out what the heck's going on, because every murder follows a punishment that would be administered to a witch, you know, stoning, drowning, etc., all of those. And that was kind of the hub behind the graphic novel. And it was just such fun to write that they came back and asked for a second one, which kind of then pushed the whole concept a lot further and a lot more esoteric, the nature of evil. Well, that was such terrific fun to write, and then it spurred, you know, other horror comics from it. But Ritual remains one of my kind of favorite guilty pleasures.
How different is it writing for like comic book writing compared to kind of fiction writing? Because obviously you're writing the main kind of dialogue, or do you have the artwork there first with a story kind of behind it?
So it's very much like writing a movie. I mean, it's a similar discipline, because you write the script and describe each, how many panels, what the artwork is going to be in each of the panels, how they link together, and then obviously the characters, dialogue, the action is all flows from that. So it's a kind of hybrid between, I guess, writing a movie script and talking through a storyboard for a film. And then the artist goes away and does the magic and then brings back artwork that is just joyous sometimes. And then you go back and think, well, I want to do more with this. I want to add extra bits, which we did on my last one, which was called Meat, which was more of a monster one, monster elimination and tactics. And that was more of a Godzilla-y kind of nod towards those monster movies. But again, I just think of it as a film, really. It's a film on paper.
I have no idea how comic books are, how my comics are made, so that's actually quite interesting to know. So, following on from Ritual, you went to Tarzan, which is an official kind of book, which is rare. You got the okay from the actual estate, didn't you?
Yes, so with that, it was terrific fun of... this comes from my work at the Sci-Fi Channel days, and we were always looking at characters that we thought may be out of copyright or available, and Tarzan was always one we looked at. But the copyright situation was a muddy mess. It actually wasn't out of copyright, and it still isn't, really. One book is in America, and that's it. But Tarzan itself is a trademark, so... Like Star Wars, you know, you can't go off and do Star Wars because Star Wars is a trademark. Likewise with Tarzan. So I'd already at this point thought how to modernize the story. not Tarzan with an iPhone, but what would happen if you met Tarzan in the jungle now? More Jane-led, and the idea being that, you know, rather than, you know, local natives as the villains, as Burroughs did, they were, you know, loggers and poachers and coltan miners, and, you know, more real modern contemporary villains that would charm with Tarzan. So I approached the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate, who are amazingly based in a town called Tarzana in Los Angeles. Okay. And everyone said, don't talk to these guys. They won't entertain you. So I sent them an email, little explanation of what I wanted to do. And then I got a phone call and they said, come over to Tarzana. Let's do it. So okay. I went over, we did three books. And we were going to do more, but the Warner Brothers film was coming out. So the books were launched for the centenary, the 2012 Tarzan centenary. And the idea was to get, not make them kids' books, but get younger readers into it, but it would still chime with the older adult readers. So you get mixed results. So a lot of kind of librarians in schools who read the book love it, but say the first chapter is very gruesome because essentially we have Tarzan ripping the throat out of a poacher. So, you know, I wanted that animalistic kind of rage and violence, but without going too far into, you know, adult rated material. And then the Warner Brothers movie happened, which kind of stalled and stemmied a lot of what we're doing. But there's some interesting life in the old Ape Man yet. That project is very far from dead. So you've heard it here first, but I'm not telling you what it is. But there is some interesting things afoot we'll talk about, no doubt, hopefully another time very soon.
A sly exclusive. I like that. Not full exclusive, but sly. Oh, yeah. It's a shame that the film didn't kind of hit well. Very, very mixed kind of reactions to the movie.
Absolutely.
The book series are amazing. So it's a shame that they couldn't maybe do a film based on the books, which would be amazing. But
there you go.
So where did you go from Tarzan? So you had your several releases of Tarzan. So what series did you go to after that?
Well, again, throughout all this, I was bobbing between movies and books. So along the way, I think just before that at the time, I'd just produced my first movie with Dolph Lundgren and Scott Adkins called Legendary, which is a monster hunter movie, which was a lot of fun. There was a couple of other projects kind of looming up film-wise. But then on the books, I just decided to go a little bit more science fiction, so out of the jungle. So we went from superheroes to the jungle to a series called The Inventory, which ended up being four books based on the very simple premise of comic books. All the old comic books used to have adverts in the back for X-ray glasses, for rocket packs or invisibility cloaks. You could buy them for like a fiver. Of course, they didn't work. And the premise was, well, what happened? Why didn't they work? It's because the real things were intercepted and placed in a giant warehouse and you got given the crap. So there's a giant warehouse somewhere with rocket cars, hoverboards, all the cool stuff we wanted as kids is real. And it's there, it's hidden away from us because we're all irresponsible. And it's essentially about that. And the first book is this underground complex owned by a secret organization. The curator and his nephew work there. And it starts off with essentially the plot of Die Hard with a bunch of rogues breaking into the inventory, which is like multi-level security. So every time you go down a level, it gets worse and worse and worse. And it's a kind of cross between Die Hard, Maze Runner, and anything with the world's coolest gadgets. So we have our heroes who are trying to outrun the bad guys to find Iron Fist, but nobody knows what Iron Fist is because everything's codenamed and it's not quite what you expect it to be. So we did four of those. That was a wonderful, fun series today. There's a lot more science fiction than anything else.
Very cool. Very cool. So let's go into your second bloody good read. What have you brought to us?
So the second one, as a slight change of pace, it's a crime thriller. And I'm not the world's biggest crime thriller fan. So it was a series of books. And the first one is called Strangers by Paul Finch. And They are such good fun. So essentially, Strangers, it's the series is about a police detective, Lucy Claiborne, who on the first chapter starts out as a newly minted detective. It all goes wrong, and by chapter two, she's demoted to, you know, beat cop in the streets around Manchester because she screwed up so badly. And it's an interesting series because Paul has done this amazing job of giving us a real strong lead character who you really sympathize with, even though she completely screws things up. And she is not the lead detective at all. She is kind of a cog in the machine. And he's just done this amazing job where this cog in the machine starts to uncover a serial killer case. And the serial killer case is rather bizarre. There's certain things about it that are not quite right, that are slightly different from normal. And as Lucy goes through just trying to find out what's going on, she goes undercover. She, you know, she's volunteering for a variety of things and gets involved with very violent gangs. It includes everything from prostitution to child smuggling, and he's crammed so much just into one book, and there's a series of books, that it takes you down the darkest paths in Manchester imaginable. And it's done in such a fresh, fun way, with such a bright voice, with this Lucy Claiborne, who all the way through you just absolutely think this is the next rock star kind of character. And it really took me out of the book in a wonderful way. Whereas with kind of murder mystery thrillers, I can tend to get bored and easily guess early on, you know, what's behind it. And it's a layer of darkness, because Paul writes a lot of horror as well. There's a layer of darkness throughout it that is just perfect for a real world crime thriller. There's no supernatural in it at all. And it's just a beautiful fusion in my view.
It's a very thin line between crime and horror. I find that with a lot of the crime fiction, because aside from horror, crime would be the next one for me. I think Mark Billingham was kind of my go-to. So I read Buried was my first one, and I thought that was amazing. And you know, I've been reading his kind of the general series from start to finish from that point. It's hard jumping halfway through, but yeah, it was such a great series. And I'll always go to kind of the crime thrillers from that point, especially the serial killer kind of stuff. But that's where you get the serial killer part. It's slasher, basically. But it's
exactly,
like Saw. Saw is pretty much a crime drama, but it's a horror. It's a I love the fine line between.
I completely agree. And that's what I said up front, that horror is just too fine a line to hover around. So, you know, even young adult superhero books can have a core of horror if that's what you like, and that's what I did. One of my all-time favorite horror film would be John Carpenter's The Thing, but you could argue to your blue in the face that that's actually a sci-fi movie, not a horror movie, but it's what is it? So I love any story that straddles those lines and merges them together,
like Aliens, because Aliens is always cast as a horror film, but I always say it's sci-fi.
Yeah.
But it's horrific sci-fi. So, yeah. Cool. I had a question. Now it's slipped from my mind. No, because I was going to say, because even in comic books, like with the Spider-Man, some of the Spider-Man arcs, like Venom is very kind of horror and kind of Man-Spider story and Morbius. And there's so much kind of horror where you don't think it's going to be horror. So it's always good. But I'm rambling. So where did you go next in your writing?
It kind of, a couple of things happened. So I ended up on the film side, starting a production company, which is doing a variety of things, from crime to horror, TV and film and theatre. We're doing a whole smorgasbord, again to use that word, of material, and around that time I'd just written a film called Crowhurst, which is a true life story about Donald Crowhurst, who fakes his own death during the world's first around the world yacht race. And he goes slowly mad. And of course, as is typical with this, the story's never been told before. And two films came out at once. The hugely budgeted Colin Firth version called The Mercy, and our little low budget film. And one of them flopped and one of them got four or five star reviews across the board, which was ours. So I was kind of pleased. And it was his descent into madness that was fantastic. And it's a true story. And by any definition, it's a horror story. I mean, this guy genuinely became convinced that he could communicate with the devil by doing mathematics. And if he went to a certain longitude and latitude or a certain time of day and killed himself, he could actually rewrite reality and go back out of the race and either win it or just go back home with his wife and kids. And it's just amazing, sad, true, but an amazing descent into the craziness of isolation. So that was terrific fun to work with. And at the same time, I was doing another movie that kind of faded from everyone's consciousness called Supervised, which was a superhero retirement home. Which on paper was fantastic, with Bo Bridges and a whole bunch of people. And I kind of then moved on the writing side just into another standalone young adult book called Drone Racer, which again was linked to my love of films and love of technology, about a bunch of kids who find an artificially intelligent drone as they enter these races. And drone racing is a big esport, and they start to win races with this super smart drone, and the super smart drone is actually on the run from the shadowy government organization that made it and just doesn't want to go into combat. So it's essentially ET with drones, and that was terrific fun. And then tangentially to that, my first book for grown-ups, for adults, which was Control S, which is a difficult one to say on a podcast because it's spelled CTRL plus S, as in the keyboard shortcut. And it's kind of a horror version, I guess, of where you'd go with Ready Player One and those kind of films. So essentially about a group of 20-somethings, and one of the mothers goes missing, and they realize that there's a virtual world that everybody uses. And I reinvented virtual reality, I guess, on the way you see it in Ready Player One, that it plugged into your emotions. So it was all emotional based, and people were harvesting emotions and selling them on. So you could, for a fee, you could experience what it's like to jump off a building and free fall and slam into the ground, because they kidnap people off the street and do it to them, record their emotions right up until death. And then you can pay for the privilege of near-death experiences. And that's what they're doing. So it turned into this lovely near-future kind of crime thriller, which operates in a virtual world, the real world, and an augmented world. So there's actually three aspects to it. And that was, again, terrific fun to write. So, there was a couple of horrific torture scenes that I got to do. I could throw my love of sci-fi, and there's a couple of action chases in there. So again, it was a real mix of all the stuff that I generally enjoy.
I'm going to catch that one. It's on my list to read, actually. I've already downloaded it. So I'm going to look forward to reading that one.
Good man.
So where did you go after Control S?
So the next step after that, well, a film that I may or may not be directing, as I mentioned, it's always the way with films. I mean, we've actually got some cast attached, and the last 2 weeks, even with what's going on, we've been out location scouting, and it's a classic haunted house movie, period haunted house movie. And it's based on a play that's been around and done very well. I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay.
Because we've been talking about this for a while, but it's really G'd up at the moment. And as tends to happen with films, most films get made because the entire film crew hurtle towards one date and assume it's being made on that date, whilst the money men haven't put anything in place yet, and that slowly comes together, and it gets more heated as that date approaches. Whereas if you just say, let's have the money and then we'll make it, it never gets made. So you kind of have to convince everyone it's getting made and then hurtle towards the start point. And then on the day you're supposed to roll, hope that all the checks clear. So that's where we're going with that. And at the same time, my latest movie came out just a few days ago in France, which is a very, very bizarre hybrid documentary natural history thriller. Okay. We've been working on this for years. In fact, the camera team have been recording stuff for 10 years. And it's a lion documentary on the surface about lions and about their plight. And there's only 17,000 lions. It's beautifully shot and edited. And they've done it so it looks like the movie 300. So I'll say that again. It looks like the movie 300. So it's beautifully graded. It looks, you know, all vivid, saturated colors. And then there's a lot of augmentation on the lions because we needed to tell the story. So there's digital scars, there's digital wounds, a lot of digital compositing right throughout the movie. And essentially it tells the plight of this one outcast lion who's the bastard king. And that's what it's called, the bastard king. Or in France, it's just come out as Le Roi Bâtard. And it's a big cinematic experience, although because of COVID, it's had a limited launch on Studio Canals on demand streaming, but the aim is still to go theatrical. And it's a very dark story. Again, that could easily be classed as a horror. I mean, if you read some of the reviews in France, you'll see there's some very violent scenes in there. But ultimately, it's also an eco story where we realize the villain in the piece is humanity. And I don't want to ruin any surprises in it, but towards the end, you think you're watching Blade Runner.
Okay.
That's all I can say. It's nothing like this has been done before. And it was very nice to see reviews recently from Le Monde and Figaro, which are like huge, respected newspapers in France, just saying it's a beautifully poetic, timely, emotional film. And I'm thinking, I can't write poetry, but they're saying it, you know, the text is like poetry. But it's such an important and fascinating film that, again, blurs animal documentary with horror, with thriller, with everything else. And it's also got this pounding modern score by two French DJs who are very famous over there. And it does not feel like you're watching a David Attenborough documentary at all. And it's actually, you know, we're steering away from the word documentary because it's a fictional story implanted in the wild. It's very difficult to pitch.
Like mockumentary, but with kind of, it's hard to picture. It's quite hard to picture.
But it's also a wildlife documentary. Everything actually happened, but then it was given a hand and there's some computer-generated stuff in there. Mm. So it's a very difficult one to pitch because we're not saying this is real. We're saying, as you'll see by the end of the film, but we're saying that this is what's going to happen to us. And we're all screwed if we don't do anything.
It must be nice to have a big studio, like Studio Canal, behind it, because Studio Canal are huge, and they do tend to get the big, big hits. So it must be nice to have, because Crowhurst was Studio Canal as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was that's another story. It wasn't Studio Canal. Studio Canal had done The Mercy, which was the big budget version. And they saw our version in the edit room and ran off and re-edited their version quite quickly and then came back and said, can we have yours? And of course, when studios do that, it's to sit on it and never, so your film never sees the light of day. And we managed amazingly to make sure that didn't happen. And Studio Canal did what they promised. And it was on after The Mercy, but it was on theatrically. You know, it's fun. So yeah, this is my second venture with those guys.
See, I can get filmy. So, what is your final bloody good read?
So my final one, I wanted to fuse what I knew we'd be talking about, which was that meandering path between books and film and various things. And it's a book I don't think gets nearly enough credit because of the film. And it is by F. Paul Wilson, and it is The Keep.
Okay.
And it's such a fun book. It's, you know, just the premise. Nazis in a Transylvanian castle with vampires. I mean, that's all you really need to know about the whole thing. And it was a Michael Mann movie, which wasn't, it wasn't the best. It's one of those, again, guilty pleasures, if you can ever find a copy, because I don't think it's readily available. But it does feel very 80s. And, I've always looked at this and thought, well, the book should be re-released and pushed wider, because it's just such a great, fun, atmospheric story. And it's ripe for a remake as well. And we have so many brilliant vampire stories out there, absolutely. But we also have so many terrible ones. And, I don't think you can do much wrong with Nazis and vampires.
The vampire genre is stretched a bit. I'll give it time. Which is one of my favourite genres as well, which is crazy.
You could do just fun things. One of another utterly fantastic film, flawless film, is American Werewolf in London. But there's the one bit when I very first saw that and it stuck with me. And I'm actually looking at, I've got a big shelf full of, not toys, inspirational figures. And I have the two Nazi werewolves, like the dream sequence, as figures, because that haunted me as a kid. Out the whole film, the transformation and everything else, it was the Nazi werewolves of that movie that stuck with me. So I think there's always a good combination when it comes to war and horror.
Nazis and horror have a very good relationship. Dead Snow is an amazing zombie one.
Yeah,
that's a brilliant soundtrack to that. Nazis and horror, you can't go wrong with that.
I just go back to The Keepers. Sorry. A book, though. It's one of those stories that, it's being copied and cloned as well. So you might read it now and go, well, yeah, why have I seen that before? But you're just suffering at the hands of actually a genuinely good, creepy horror story, meandering around a castle, spooky things happening, occasional soldier getting the throat ripped out, and what's actually behind it all. So it's when I was mulling over my bookshelves, thinking, what book would I really like to throw down and say it needs a revival? I that's the one that just sprung off.
I had to get that one go. I do like vampires, so my interest is peaked. Some of the best ones I've read, Ray Garton did Nightlife, which is a kind of vampires in a brothel, basically. But it's done so much better than, say, Dusk Till Dawn or something like that. It was such a great kind of gritty Americanized vampire novel. And then you've also got the Necroscope series as well, which is always a great series. Yeah. So absolutely. No, definitely one to add to my list of vampires. So what have you got coming up next? I know there's lots of stuff we can't talk about and lots of hush, but what about your book series? Any more book series that you're kind of working on?
There's a couple of things. One, which is it crosses genre. It's a Michael Crichton-esque thriller with a whole bunch of real science, but also a horror edge, which is going out very soon, which one of us, me and my agent, have got high hopes for. so that's something that I've done, and we're slowly pushing that out. As I say, that the film I'm looking to direct. And then book-wise, I've always wanted to do a pure horror book. Mm-hmm. A real nice, more in the world of kind of Carrie, Christine, not just stories about girls' names, but those wonderful kind of stories, as opposed to jumping in doing a zombie or a werewolf. I want to do something that is just a little bit more frothy and fun, but hyper scary. So that's my next mission. Really is to launch that string of books and see how they go.
Awesome. A horror book like that would be good. I do like Christine. It's one of my favorite King ones. I don't know why. Always Yeah, always one that always sticks with me, Christine. I do like that one. So let's go back. Let's have a little chat about some horrors then. So you're a slasher fan.
Yeah, more of the kind of older school slasher ones.
The '80s kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean the Candyman and the Nightmare on Elm Street, because there was a certain irreverence behind them, which made them fun. When it kind of gets a little too kind of serious, I kind of wane interest a little bit. So I like that level of fun or uniqueness. And again, you mentioned Aliens before. I mentioned The Thing. Anything that can kind of straddle over those lines, so it takes you in unexpected territory, I just think make wonderful horror stories.
Favorite 80s slasher? you worked on Freddy vs. Jason, so it's a good question to ask.
Well, yeah, no, it is. But then, I would have said before, even not working on that, that just for its sheer fun element is I can't even remember which. Is it number three? Dream Warrior?
Dream Warriors.
I'm blanking on the title now. That's all. And of course, the original Hellraiser.
See, I love the original Hellraiser, but if you listen, I'll have to send you a link to the podcast because the boys hate it. And it's an ongoing argument now of why did you choose this? Because it's really good. No, it's not. And it's just, my co-host Niall absolutely hates it. To the point where
not only to the point that it's such a fun story. If you're going to watch the movie, you're actually, and again, this is a problem with time. You're watching a film that had revolutionary prosthetic effects in it, like The Thing. And so you're looking at things that you'd never seen before on the screen. And that's such, I mean, so you had a great story. You had something that was genuinely, not only scary, but fun. It was scary fun. And then you had these, the Cenobites. You had the real visual horror of it to lure you in. And you hadn't seen anything so good. You hadn't seen anything like that. And, sometimes I think horror, even the best horror, fails because the audiences are slightly jaded, even though the actual work itself is just impeccable.
People don't know how to kind of chill out and enjoy it. People pick apart it too much. It has to be too real nowadays. And I miss the 80s. I miss the kind of the classic slashes. And, my favourite film of all time is Scream 2. I'll never.
Fantastic.
I'll always stick by that.
Well, I always remember when Scream came out, being surprised because that was back in the day. When we were doing Freddy vs. Jason, we had tons of horror scripts, and that was originally called Scary Movie, which then became the parody of Scream. But the original Scream script was called A Scary Movie. So when they came out of Scream, I went, "Oh, I'd read that years ago." That was terrific fun. And the other thing as well is, and this problem we can't escape now, are spoilers. I mean, when you watched Hellraiser, when you watched any of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, the biggest spoiler you had were your mates who had watched it.
Yeah.
You didn't have the entire plot ruined by somebody who had a grudge because they'd had a similar idea once upon a time.
And, yeah, the internet does spoil a lot more. You do get to find it. TV shows are one of the worst ones to get ruined. But it always reminds me, like the 80s, it's that Simpsons scene where Homer's leaving Star Wars. And he goes, "Who would have ever known?" Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you got to go on Twitter in half an hour of program being on. So anyway, I can talk about horror movies forever. So. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been lovely chatting to you. Where can people find you on social media?
Best place to hit me up is at A Briggs Writer on Twitter. Somebody else called Andy Briggs stole my name. So at A Briggs Writer, and hit me up there. Yeah, I'm always open for people throwing questions and saying hello and various things on there. It's the best place to find me. I'm all over the internet in every other nook and cranny, but that's the one I engage with the most when I've got time. But no, wonderful. Thank you for the invite. It's been a lot of fun.
No, that's like we you know, you've been to Waterstones and can book signing with me for so many years.
Oh yeah.
You're one of the main authors I wanted to get on the podcast, so I've crossed another one off my list.
Thank you. Well, if I'll tell you, if this film gets to be directed, then we should do a little podcast special, you and I.
No, definitely. Come on to the horror cast. We'll have you on.
A deal. Yeah, we'll do that on set. Put a face mask on. Sit a mile away from me, and enjoy the experience.
I am always happy to wear a mask for a set visit. So don't you worry about that. So, as always, thank you for listening to Bloody Good Reads. I have been your host, Mark Goddard. You can catch me over on Twitter in two places, as always. At Snakebite Horror, which is my personal Twitter, which you have Bloody Good Read updates, and you'll have the Snakebite Horror cast and Snakebite Horror updates as well. You can catch us also on Twitter at Bloody Good Reads, Instagram at Bloody Good Reads, and at Snakebite Horror. And you can also catch me every fortnight on the Horror Cast, where me, Niall, and Marcus will review horror films in our own interesting way. We have a new episode coming up. So when this episode will be released, we'll be doing our Halloween special, which is me and the boys reviewing Halloween, Friday the 13th, and Nightmare on Elm Street, which I believe most of those Niall hasn't seen yet. So this is going to be an interesting one. So contact us, let us know how you're enjoying the podcast. And also a quick shout out to our sponsor, Abominable Book Club. It is the monthly subscription box for some great horror and thriller fiction. Yeah, a brand new book, a secondhand book, some extras in there as well, magazines, snacks if you go for the higher tier. And as always, you can get 10% off your first box with the code Bloody Good Reads, and you can get them over at the abominablebookclub.cratejoy.com. and go check them out and use the code, get some money off and get some awesome books. They're just started taking for the November box, so yeah, go and see what they've got over there, and awesome. So, as always, thank you for listening. I have been your host, Mark Goddard, and I will see you next time.